Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Trends in U.S. International Development Agencies. What do the numbers and the trends tell us? First, a couple of numbers. As of late 2023, 84% of organization heads in international development in the U.S. are white, 73% of leadership teams are white, 67% of board members are white, and 4% of chief executives are women who are either Black, Indigenous, or otherwise people of color. So you may wonder, what have the DEI trends been like, especially since 2020, when not just here in the US, but in many parts of the globe, we saw a wave of renewed attention to diversity, equity, and inclusion in the workplace, and to anti-racism. Lots of international development agencies got on board, made statements about their intentions, and started implementing some actions. How many actions? What kinds of actions? Did they sustain? Was it meaningful? Where have we seen most progress when it comes to DEI? And where has it been insignificant? Where has there remained most stagnation? Somebody who really can put her fingers on it with hard numbers is Shiro Gnanaselvam, CEO of Social Impact, a US-based evaluation consulting company. Social Impact spearheaded a survey, first in 2021 and now again in 2023, so we can see some early trends. Shiro is here to talk about those trends. You're in for an important conversation. And by the way, if you do not live and work in the US, it may still be worthwhile to compare these trends with those in your country. Hello, and welcome to NGO Soul and Strategy, the podcast for NGO leaders and managers who look change right in the eye. My name is Tosca Bruno van Vijveken, and I'm the founder and principal consultant at Five Oaks Consulting. I have over 3 decades of experience helping leaders in civil society manage change, invest in cutting-edge leadership development, lead organizational culture change, and strengthen effectiveness. I'm also a thought leader on these issues, including as co-author of the book Between Power and Irrelevance, The Future of Transnational NGOs, which is read by civil society leaders across the globe. If you are such a leader and want to look change right in the eye, this podcast is for you.
Hello, everybody. This is Tosca at NGO Soul and Strategy. And today we have a stellar show. I am also at the same time working in a little bit of a handicapped way in the sense that I last night got into an accident with my computer. And so I am recording this on my iPad. So to our listeners, please, I apologize in advance if this recording is going to be slightly different from the normal ones, because I'm working with an unusual recording device here. Well, so what is the Stellar Show all about? I am very excited about this. Let me start with some data to ground us all in the topic we're going to discuss today, which is the state of diversity, equity, and inclusion by the numbers, particularly coming from the US for the international development sector, both nonprofit as well as for-profit agencies in that sector. So let me give you a couple of numbers. 84% of organizations in the US international development sector are white. They're still white. 73% of leadership teams are white. 67% of board members are white. And only 4% of chief executives are women who are either people of color, Black, or Indigenous. So while some in our sector NGOs, philanthropies, nonprofits, and for-profits in international development have paid attention to diversity, equity, inclusion for 10 years or longer. For many of us, the impetus to give it increased attention started, of course, after the murder of George Floyd here in the US in 2020. That focus on DEI, as well as anti-racism, and those two are not the same, of course, did reverberate across the globe. But what we're addressing in this podcast is, what do the data actually tell us about how well we are doing compared to what we say we're doing? What do the numbers and the stories tell us? We have some numbers now to pin this down, and that is thanks to my guest today, Shiro Gnanaselvam, CEO at the Evaluation Consulting Group Social Impact, and her colleagues who initiated, thankfully, two surveys, one in 2021 and one this year, 2 years later, to collect data. So I can't wait to dig into that data with Shiro. Shiro, welcome.
Thank you so much, Tosca. I'm so glad to be here.
It's terrific that we're going to have this conversation. So listeners, let me introduce you to Shiro, her brief bio. She's the CEO, as I said, of Social Impact, which is a US-based mid-sized consulting company that offers monitoring, evaluation, and learning services to the international development sector. Shiro also was the executive vice president and chief operating officer at Social Impact before. She was also the CEO of AfriCare, the largest and oldest African-American founded international NGO focused exclusively on the continent of Africa. And before that, she was the senior director for monitoring and evaluation at the Millennium Challenge Corporation. So, Shiro, to start us off and get us all on the same page, why does social impact exist? What do you offer?
So Social Impact is a management consulting firm, and we are dedicated to advancing development effectiveness. And the way we do that is by helping our clients to plan for, measure, evaluate, and learn from their programs. And most importantly, to use what they have learned to adapt their programming and improve it so that they can, have better programmatic results. So ultimately, our work is, it's a bit of a chain from what we do to the end goal we have in mind. But the end goal that we have in mind is that through our work in evaluation and research and learning, that we are going to ultimately help to improve people's lives.
Got it. And just for the record, what's the size of your consulting agency? How many staff do you have?
Yeah, so we are about 200 staff globally. About half of those are affiliated with our headquarters and the way we define that is not so much geographically, but really people who work across multiple projects. And then the other half are staff who are usually hired in countries where we have long-term MEL support contracts, and they are dedicated to a single project.
Got it. So the Bridge Survey, as it's called, which we're going to talk about today, and we'll link to the latest report in the show notes for this. So what were the origins of the Bridge Survey? Why did you start this? And I know you were quite centrally involved in that. Is that correct?
Yes. So, in the opening, you referenced, what was happening in 2020 and the murder of George Floyd, this sort of great introspection that came following that, right? And social impact was not alone in that. You know, many organizations were looking inward too. Really galvanized by that terrible event and the social justice movement that came after. And we were looking inward at ourselves. And one of the things I said to my team at the time was, you know, we had gathered our own data, right? This was, you know, the racial, ethnic profile of our staff and gender and so on. And I said, so how do we stack up against a benchmark, the industry, for instance? Mm. And the answer was, we don't know. And so I thought, gosh, that's curious, particularly, you know, leading a measurement company, right? Right. So we looked, you know, like we looked, you know, deeply and far and wide to try and find this data, and we didn't find it. And so at that point, I thought to myself, you know, we should do something about it. Like we shouldn't not know, right? And, you know, I felt like we had some of the capabilities to gather the survey. Like we know as a measurement company, we know a thing or two about, you know, putting survey together and disseminating it and gathering the results and analyzing and so on. But we couldn't do it alone, right? Because we had to reach out to the as far as we could across the sector. So, you know, I made a few calls and to my friends in development, and we got a group of folks who were really interested in kind of, you know, gathering this data. And that was the genesis of it. And in this group were, you know, for-profit companies, nonprofit organizations, very importantly, some of the industry associations. So Humentum was part of it. Interaction was part of it. You know, PSC, CIDC, which represents the for-profit companies, you know, they came in. And so with, so we had sort of in us, we had the measurement and survey capabilities. Then we had other companies who brought sort of DEI perspectives. And then we had associations who would help us to disseminate the survey. And so we all brought different strengths and then we put it together.
Got it.
And we had to design that survey from scratch. So we had Bridge 1.0 in 2021. And then we decided that we should repeat it and see what happens. So it was a really, I thought, you know, it was a really great sort of grassroots effort. Everyone was doing it because they wanted to create a public good for all of us.
I love that.
To do it. And I think that in itself is like a really, you know, good story.
It totally is a public good for all of it. I love that framing. And yes, a shout out also to Interaction, to our colleagues at Interaction and Humentum for making this possible, along with, as Shiro just said, a big group of other volunteers. So you already covered, Shiro, the types of international development agencies here in the US that are covered as a population. By this survey or these two surveys. Tell us a little bit more about the numbers and importantly, the shift in numbers since 2021. And I'm also interested in your perspectives on what do you think are the strengths of this methodology and where do you also want to point out any weaknesses, if at all, that you see in it?
Yeah. So maybe I'll start with the last question first and kind of frame it with the methods. So, so first of all, the survey in both rounds was an institutional survey, right? So one survey per organization. And, you know, that allowed us to gather a certain kind of data, right, of like organizational level metrics, right, and demographics. But it also meant that we didn't collect other kinds of data. So we, you know, and that is like, you know, people often think about when you're thinking of DEI, right? Because we were not surveying individuals, we were not able to capture lived experience. So we're not able to say, well, you know, this percent of survey respondents felt, you know, included or not, or that they can speak up or they feel seen or heard, right? We couldn't get it. Another thing that, you know, we had to sort of draw some boundaries on was which organizations, right? Because we work globally. And this is something, you know, with round one, we spent a lot of time talking about with our advisory council. We ultimately decided to focus just on U.S. registered organizations, right? And part of it was just like practical. Like we had to be able to put our arms around it and do it. We just saw so many complications if we were to sort of reach beyond the boundaries of the U.S. where like definitions of like race may or may not be applicable, right? And then ethnicity would have so many different categories. So we decided to just, since the genesis too was very U.S.-centric, we said, okay, we're going to focus on U.S.-based organizations and just sort of the headquarters part. Then you asked about so that both is it's a plus because it allowed us to wrap our arms around it and gather some data, but it's a minus because then we're not capturing the entirety of our organizations and the sector, right? The other thing is that this is a voluntary survey, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there is no like master list of every that we were aware of of all the organizations in our entire sector in the US. And so we worked with the membership lists of the big associations. And then we worked with other organizations. So like the membership lists of Interaction, Humantum, CIDC. But then we also got help from like CIDUS, for example, that, you know, publicized the survey. We, our advisory council helped us do. We just blasted it on social media. And so we captured who we captured. but we don't have any way of figuring out if, you know, we can make these sort of then broad extrapolations to the entire sector, right?
Generalization one has to then be careful with. Just to be clear, Shiro, do you know largely for a fact that it was people in the what we used to call headquarters and now increasingly is called differently, et cetera. But let's say the global centers of the U.S. part of these U.S. registered entities. And I'm saying that partially, and we will return to that later, but as you know, DEI is interpreted differently across the world. In effect, there's quite a bit of pushback, and we'll return to that. From outside the U.S. on an overly U.S.-centric interpretation mm-hmm. of this. But do you know, was it primarily U.S.-based people probably who filled in the survey on behalf of their institution?
Yes, we believe so. We were very clear in the instructions for the survey about who would be best placed to fill it. Very often it would be, you know, head of HR or people and culture, or whatever you want to call it, within the sort of headquarters operation that would be likely to have access to all the data that would be needed. So we think it was, and, you know, based on the responses and, you know, sometimes like we always gave, there was an email that you could, if you had questions about, or what is the, how exactly should I interpret this survey question or whatever. And so the people we were interacting with were always US-based.
Yeah, and as you
senior
already said,
human resource officials. And in some cases, it was actually the CEO of the organization that responded.
I see, yeah. And as you said, it was primarily organization that self-selected to do the
yes.
survey. And so we need to keep that in mind. Now, yeah.
There's one other thing, if I may point mm-hmm. out, and, you know, when folks, like, I encourage folks to go and read the report, but there was a big difference between the respondents in the first wave of the survey, both mm-hmm. in number, but also in composition. So in number, so keep in mind, the first wave happened right after, shortly after, not that long after the murder of George Floyd, right? We had 166 respondents. In the second wave, we had 88, so roughly half. Many of the very small organizations did not respond. And what we found was that three quarters of the respondents in the second round in 2023 had signed on to some kind of DEI commitment, you know, whether it was interactions pledge or the creed pledge. And so this gave us a sense that that was, that, you know, there might be a certain bias, right? Like, you know, yeah. the folks that are responding to the survey now are those that are, you know, pretty invested in making meaningful DEI change in their organizations. And so, you know, we had to account for that in how we analyzed the data. And, you know, there's a good methodology annex in the report that, you know, readers can see how we did it so that when we report the results, you know, there can be confidence in what we're saying.
Super. Yeah, you actually preempted a question. So let's go to what's most important, which is the actual data, right? So Shira, would you please start by giving us a kind of a top level summary of the core findings in terms of, in your analysis, what has not changed much since 2021 and what has changed a lot, what you think is significant, and then we'll unpack that in subsequent.
So there are two big things that have not changed, right? One is that on racial and ethnic minorities remain underrepresented in positions of power in the sector. This was like the number one finding in the first survey, and it continues to be the same this round. The second big finding is that female representation is very strong in our sector at all levels, and including at the CEO level. And actually, I should say white female representation, very strong.
Exactly.
And so that's a very powerful and positive story. It becomes less positive when you apply an intersectional lens. Right. And so Rather. I'll just leave it there and then we can unpack it because you said we were going to do that. So those are the things that have not changed and they are very big outcomes of interest. In terms of what has changed, for me, the most significant thing that has changed is that organizations have invested a lot in governance arrangements for DEI over the last 2 years in terms of having DEI policies and, you know, building it into their strategies and things like that. Another thing that has changed is that we're seeing some modest improvements in how diversity data are captured. So this was another interesting finding that particularly maybe for us, because we're like, always interested in data. But we found that in round one, the data itself was not necessarily inclusive, right? So for example, most organizations were capturing gender in a binary way. It's either male or female, right? But gender may not be binary, right? Or like the race ethnicity categories would be very limited, where, like, you know, somebody would be looking at the list and going, well, gosh, there's like none of these things apply to me. Like, which box should I check, right? And so what we saw in this round is that organizations, actually a third of organizations, have said that they have changed their categories to make them more inclusive. So that was important. And then on the disability side, because, you know, we looked at three dimensions of diversity, race, ethnicity is one, gender was the other, disability was the third. What we saw, well, our interpretation of what we saw was that there is greater awareness So like in the disability, for instance, we saw a very high incidence in the second round of I don't know responses. And the way and particularly at the board level, where we thought it was unlikely that organizations would be doing surveys of their board members to ask about their, you know, demographic characteristics, right? Mm-hmm. In the first round, like, you know, the response was 90% of our board members don't have a disability. But in this round, we saw that organizations were reporting 66% of the time, I don't know, right? So we thought, oh, gosh, this is interesting. Maybe it means there is greater awareness that, you know, disabilities are not always visible. And so just because you don't see it doesn't mean that somebody doesn't have a disability. Ah. And if you haven't asked them, it may be better to say, I don't know, rather than to say no disability. So
I'm so glad you highlighted this because I had not understood social impact interpretation of this. So now I'm quite clear that because that intrigued me as well. Yeah, just to make sure that we capture some numbers. Coming back to your first point, so from a staff composition perspective, you said that what has not changed much is the racial or ethnic representation in the sector, and again on female representation being strong, including at leadership, but limited primarily to white females. So what were the numbers in 2021 and 2023 for racial and ethnic representation among staff across the board, roughly?
So among staff in 21, it was 37%. In 23, it was 40% across the board. Mm-hmm. Then at the leadership level, you know, that is a BIPOC staff with 37 and 40. Leadership level BIPOC staff were 27, 29 for 21 and 23. And then let me go to the CEO level. This I know. So we asked a question that is very much about the intersection of race and gender. And in 21, 10% of CEOs were BIPOC. And in 23, 18% were BIPOC. And okay. So it seems like at the CEO level that's a big change. However, we pointed out two things in our report that you know, leave us with the conclusion that that's an overstatement of improvement. And here's why. We saw that the absolute number of BIPOC CEOs did not change from 21 to 23. However, as I told you earlier, the number of responding organizations did, right? So the numerator stayed the same, the denominator got less. Right? The percentage went up.
Yeah.
So we don't, you know, I mean, so we don't, there's a lot we don't know. I mean, it doesn't mean the same, you know, absolute number, right? The same organization counting and so on. Not knowing any of those things, we are just very cautious about that change, quote unquote, that we saw. And we think it's overstated. And so that's why we say, you know, we don't think across any of the dimensions there's really been a change.
Right, yeah.
The other thing, Tosca, I wanted to mention is that in both 21 and 23, 1 in 5 leadership teams were all white. That was quite stunning to me. Right? In both 2021 and 2023, 1 in 5 leadership teams were all white.
I see, all white.
Yeah.
And so that remained the same.
Yeah.
Interesting. So I just want to look back to just when Shira or I, for our, I'm very sensitive to the fact that a lot of our listeners are not based in the US. So the term, again, when we use the term BIPOC or BIPOC, it means, let me see if I get this right, Shira, it means Black, Indigenous, and People of Color staff, correct?
Correct. Correct.
Yes, because that's a term that is not so commonly known across all
Absolutely.
The regions of the world. The thing I also wanted to look back to for a moment is that percentage of staff, so roughly around 27 to 29 or around 30-ish percent, maybe a little bit more. But I remember you saying also that actually people of color and Black and Indigenous people who are staff, there's a lot of a revolving door. There's a lot of not great retainment, right, of such staff. Is there
right.
something that the survey can point us to in that regard, or is that, am I getting too much into the weeds?
Yeah, no. I mean, this was also an important point that we found that we asked, you know, in the last year, how many or what percent of your new hires were BIPOC? And then what mm-hmm. percent of your terminations or departures were BIPOC, right? And so the finding was that on average, 36% of all new hires were BIPOC in the preceding mm-hmm. year.
Mm-hmm.
And then 29% of all departures were BIPOC.
Mm.
And so, you know, not a huge difference, right? I mean, so there seems to be both when you consider sort of the general composition, the fact that none of these, there hasn't been a change even at the staff level, and certainly not at the leadership levels in BIPOC representation, and that the percentage of BIPOC individuals coming in and leaving an organization are pretty close, right? 36% coming in, 29% leaving.
I know.
That it does seem that there is, it's just that there are, you know, there's individuals moving around from one organization to another, but not necessarily like a net increase in BIPOC individuals coming into our sector. And that's also like held out if you look at the demographic profile of higher education programs that tend to feed the global development sector, right? So if you look at the social sciences and so on, they're actually very similar to the data that we report in Bridge, which is, you know, predominantly female, predominantly white.
Yeah. And so I just wanted to call that out. And I'm now tempted, but I will not go and speculate around what that might say about organizational culture and so on. But let's move on to give you the opportunity to talk about some of the other data. Now, we do have to say, of course, and I remember you mentioned that in your summary, that there are only 2 years that have passed between the two surveys. Is there something you want to say to that about how much change one can expect on this type of topic or not?
Yeah. So I think, you know, both in terms of just generally race and ethnicity and the representation of racial minorities in senior positions. I mean, I think it's fair to say that those positions are ones that don't turn over that often, right? So the opportunity to enter those positions do come up less frequently. So that is something that certainly at the CEO level, you know, something that we thought about as we were sort of drawing our conclusions and forming our recommendations. However, it was a bit disheartening because we also saw that the sort of the senior management level was static, right? That didn't increase from round one to round two either.
I know.
And so what are the prospects then, right, that in 2 years from now, if the senior leadership team is where you're cultivating, who may be like the future CEO, and if we're not seeing more BIPOC representation there, and in fact, if 1 in 5 organizations are still predominant all white leadership teams, then that's kind of concerning. And so, I think one of our recommendations is that organizations need to think. I think a lot of times we think about, oh, we need to bring like new talent into the organization, and so that's like the DEI policy might focus very heavily on the recruitment side, but there's also the growth, the retention, the coaching, the mentoring that also needs to happen, right? And so,
and the sponsoring also.
And the sponsoring, the active sponsoring. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And again, it would be so interesting to talk about those aspects, but let's not go there. There was one thing that I wanted to have you talk about also a little bit more, and that is about, so you mentioned in your high-level summary that there's good progress on DEI governance, in other words, the policies, DEI council use, focal points, etc., internal transparency on composition of staff, although I noticed that there was detail there, but anything you want to further elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think those changes we felt were very, very significant. Like for instance, 80% of private sector respondents to the survey have a DEI policy, right? Keeping in mind that across the board in 2021, when we did the survey, only I think 25% of organizations had a DEI policy. So now to see that in private sector, 80% have it is pretty significant. There's like more than half have DEI councils. I think just the fact that organizations are integrating these into like their strategies and their organizational values and so on. We thought this is all important because these are kind of enduring changes, right? It's not just, oh, I hired a consultant and they came and did a training and, next year I won't fund that consultant in the budget. But these are like you change your strategy, your 5-year strategy. That's kind of a done deal, or you write a policy, right? The internal transparency, that also went up, and that was, we thought, significant. The external transparency declined. We're still thinking about that, right? What does that mean? Do you need to have external transparency? Or is it sufficient to have just your staff hold you accountable, right? I think you're right. I think both are important.
Next steps. Don't you think it ups the sense of urgency if there is some external transparency? That's at least what I've seen in the private sector, that often the advice is if you really want to up the sense of urgency, you need to make some numbers and as well as your objectives externally transparent.
Yeah. And I think this is where, maybe in our industry where funders play an important role, where maybe there can be some incentive to do that, funders should be requiring organizations to, if you want to like participate in our procurements, you should like publish this on your website, publish your data, like just against like maybe 5 metrics.
One thing also at a high level, I want to ask you, can you say something in general Shira, about how the nonprofits in your sample, in your population, how they fared vis-a-vis for-profits. You've highlighted here and there, but sometimes we in the nonprofit sector tend to like to think that we are, quote unquote, morally better than the private sector. I'm not always so fond of that assumption, of that mindset. How do we come out as an NGO sector vis-a-vis the private sector in the US in this regard?
I think so. It's a little bit mixed, but generally speaking, I think the for-profit sector did better. And I wondered about that. We talked about that as we were going through the results and analyzing them. And I wonder if it's a function of being just like more like responsive and agile, you know, the ability to be a little more agile in making changes. So we saw it in the, even in the transparency, right? You know, for profits, you know, 70% share their gender composition internally, 63% of for profits share the race internally. Nonprofits were lower. They were like around 52, 53. I can't remember the exact number. I think also in terms of the BIPOC CEOs, for-profits seem to have done better than nonprofits. In aggregate, you know, there hasn't been like much of a change. But if we were looking at the for-profit versus nonprofit, for-profits seem to have done a bit better. And there's, I don't know if this phenomenon was happening in our sector, but I've been reading about how over the last year, you know, the year before, remember, there was all this talk about the great resignation and post-COVID, right? Well, evidently from some sort of like broad industry surveys, there's data that says there has been a great resignation at the CEO level, just generally in nonprofit organizations, for-profit organizations. And if that was also replicated in our sector, I don't know that it has, but if it was, it would be interesting. You know, it seems that maybe as those positions became vacant in our sector at an unusually higher rate, right? Because normally at the CEO level, it doesn't turn over that frequently, that the for-profit organizations were a little more agile in being able to attract people of color into those CEO roles versus, say, nonprofits, that there hasn't been, you know, that much of a shift. So generally speaking, I think we saw that for-profits were a little more active.
Okay, so your thinking was, if the Great Resignation, this wave of people who resigned from jobs, and again, there was, I believe that this was a phenomenon. Well, one can discuss to what extent it really happened, I believe, but your thinking is that if there was more turnover in the for-profit sector, there was also more opportunity to in an agile way, choose people of color to be new CEOs, for instance, may have happened. Yeah, I can totally see that point of view. One last question that I'm also still curious about before we look at it from a different lens, and that is size. In the research that at one point in my past career I was a part of, and that I'm somewhat sometimes still exposed to, often size matters a lot for lots of organizational behavior, characteristics, etc. Was that the case in this survey as well, or not so much?
Definitely. I think that just with size comes access to resources. Yeah. And therefore the ability to get things done. So I think smaller organizations, first of all, like just even in the respondents to the survey, right? We saw the most attrition from very small organizations. So I think that in itself says something, that small organizations struggle to even, you know, spend the time to take a survey that might ultimately provide some data to help them, right? And then we saw it this time in this round of the survey, we asked quite a few open-ended questions. And in the responses we got, I mean, it was really the small organizations. You know, we don't know where to start. I mean, you know, we don't have the resources. Not having resources, not having sufficient resources seem to be across the board thing. But larger organizations, obviously, like the larger organizations were the ones that were more likely to have, you know, a DEI focal point, for instance, right? Somebody dedicated to have those responsibilities, either solely or at least as part of their other responsibilities to focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Maybe before, towards the end of our interview, I want to make sure that we also touch upon this. What should we think about the resistance that we have noticed in, and I think quite understandably so, by parts of the international development organizations outside the US to the topic of DEI, their argument being that DEI should be interpreted or should not be interpreted, I should say, as a US-specific need or issue. And we've seen a similar resistance within, at least, I don't know much about the private sector, but within the nonprofit sector, we've seen resistance of staff in other than US-based, let's say, members, affiliates, et cetera, right? Parts of the organization against DEI as being an overly kind of American-framed issue. What should we think about that? And I know you have some thoughts also about how we maybe should link this more to localization as a topic that we have done.
Yeah, and so this was something that we saw quite clearly in the qualitative responses that we got, that there is this tension between what is considered sort of U.S. domestic DEI, this idea of global DEI, if you are, you know, let's say a global nonprofit, and then localization, and that these things are kind of colliding in a very operational way, right? So conceptually, you know, DEI and let's say localization, they're inherently connected, right? I mean, shifting power is common to both. Equity is common to both. Inclusion is common to both. But operationally, they have been separated, starting with, I think, sort of the funder community, right, where they're like dealt with in different parts of the organization. They're not part of a single framework. And, you know, is localization part of DEI? Is DEI part of localization? And then that gets sort of then filters over to the implementer community as well, where organizations like the ones that took the survey are, you know, like, okay, we have, you know, like we do like localization work in our programs and we do DEI internally in our organizations. But what happens when you are a international NGO and you got a country office with, you know, let's say in Uganda with the Ugandan national, who's your country director and a full Ugandan staff, is that DEI when you're trying to come up with like a global policy on, say, Ray, I don't know, DEI generally for your entire organization, or is that localization, you know? And so it's, I think operationally it's very unclear, and it was so sort of palpable in the feedback that people gave, that this is like a complicating factor. And, it, you know, in our minds, maybe it doesn't need to be because there's so much that is similar between the two. And can you not leverage if you change the focus from being about, you know, localization and DEI, but start to talk about the the things that are the connectors, the power shifting, equity, inclusion, and make that the language of what you do so that you can come up with, say, common principles, common language, common terminology that connects the two. Maybe that is something that will help organizations, because right now they're telling us through the survey that they're kind of paralyzed, like they don't know what to do. And particularly when resources are limited, right?
Yeah.
And we saw that organizations have done all this foundation building, but they're kind of stuck. You know, they don't know where to go. Like they don't know how to move to implementation. Like this is another reason that they get stuck.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. I had not realized it before. Very, very helpful. So as we have to bring this interview to a close, Shiro, what is the call to action in your mind coming out of these surveys or calls to action?
Yeah. So, you know, we have sort of two buckets of calls to action, right? One bucket is at the sectoral level. And it's the first point there is very related to what we were just talking. Can we come up with some kind of sector level framework that aligns DEI and localization and helps to move from just this sort of thinking about these different things to actually acting on them and in a way that is clear and not as resource intensive for organizations. A second is that, you know, funders need to sort of support power shifting within development organizations as much as they're supporting power shifting from U.S. organizations to local organizations. So I think there's a very clear call to action, certainly on the USG side and from USAID, about this is what we want to see. To your point about, like, you know, transparency on the metrics, external transparency, right? But who's holding? So like, okay, like we're going to say we're going to shift 25% of resources going directly to local organizations. As somebody who was born and raised in the Global South, that makes eminent sense to me. Right. But in the meantime, there's 75% that's still going to U.S. organizations. Right. Who's holding those organizations accountable for, you know, equally important shifts in power that, you know, that matter in the United States. Right. So I think funders have a role to play to incentivize that change. I think at the sector level, organizations need to help each other. Particularly to help smaller organizations. That's, I think, the only way that we're going to see a shift from sort of, oh, we're building the foundation, we're making the plans, we're, you know, hiring a DEI focal point to actually, okay, now we're doing something with all these, you know, framework that we put in place. And here, I think sector associations like Interaction and Creed and so on can play such a big role.
You're reading my mind. Yes.
Yeah. And then I think the last point, and this is also where I think the sector associations can be play an important role, is that when I think about the talent pipeline in tertiary education systems that is going to feed the global development sector, right? We talked about how those are, you know, predominantly female, predominantly white in the disciplines that tend to feed our sector, right?
Yeah.
Right. So that's fact number one. Fact number two is that with the recent Supreme Court decision on affirmative action, there's a shift in like the diversity representation, right, of like entrance into the job market. Pretty soon it's, right, so it's going to become even harder to have sort of people of color in our talent pipeline. And so I think sector associations, organizations need to join forces to kind of think about, okay, this is the new reality in which we're operating. What are we going to do? Like, how are we going to, work with minority serving institutions? Well, minority serving institutions, I'm sure, are getting inundated. I certainly know that was the case like 2 years ago, right? Everybody wanted to do a partnership. Or should there be like an industry level partnership where there can be, you know, programs like that can get developed like jointly, there can be, you know, mentorship opportunities, apprenticeship pipelines, all of those things. But if they're developed more at the sector level to feed the entire industry rather than these sort of bilateral things, I think that might be benefit all and be a more manageable lift on the side of the minority serving institutions. So I think those are the things on the at the sector level that should happen. And then I think there are these like sort of organizational level shifts, right? That we said this, we gave this recommendation last time, and we need to repeat it because as we were talking, particularly in terms of race and ethnicity, there hasn't been a shift in the 2 years, right? And so we have to be very intentionally focused on shifting power in our organizations, you know, talking about succession planning, building that into our DEI policy, setting term limits for like at the CEO level and the board level so that positions can open up and that individual, you know, BIPOC individuals have a chance to compete for these positions, right? So that's one. I think continuing to keep the focus on accountability. So the changes on internal transparency is great. But if we can also like try, as you were noting, to push for external transparency, that would be good. And then finally, like really getting whatever help we can get as individual organizations to move from strategy to action. Because I worry that we're going to just, you know, keep building the foundation and say, oh, we've done DEI because we have a DEI council and we have a DEI policy and we have a DEI focal point. But, you know, we have to like start implementing all of those things in our organizations.
Well, that is a pretty fundamental and significant set of call to actions or calls to action, I should say. I'm really grateful that Social Impact has started this survey. I think it's doing an important service to the community. So really, my hat off to you and to those who are with you in doing this. Where should people go, Shiro, if they want to find out about you as an individual, about the Bridge survey findings? And again, Bridge is the name of the survey, and about Social Impact as an agency.
The survey, the report, everything you need to know about Bridge is sitting on our website. So it's socialimpact.com/bridge. We have the report there as we, you know, do different webinars and so on. We post those there as well. We are going to be over the next, I would say like 4 to 5 months, we're going to be doing some deep dive blogs. So in about a couple of weeks, we'll do a sort of high level blog about our findings, but then we're going to, you know, dig deep and look more closely at gender and race and ethnicity. How does it impact small businesses? What do we want to say about this sort of DEI localization tension? Can we think through like what such a framework might be in a little more detail. And we're not going to write all of those blogs. We're, you know, asking, we have a lot of experts on our advisory council this time around. So we're hoping they will pick up the mantle, and some of them already have. So a lot to kind of keep an eye on and, you know, and keep engaging. I mean, my biggest call to action, Tosca, is that organizations use this data. You know, it makes me so happy when, you know, we write a report and then somebody takes it and uses it. So, you know, take this data, compare it to your own organization, you know, use it as a springboard to talk in your, within your, with your staff, you know, look at some of the strategies and things that organizations are doing and see, like, is there something that you can do? But use the data.
Yes, absolutely. That is the whole point, right? And Shira, you yourself, may people find you on LinkedIn or on Social Impact's website or both? Or
on both, yes. I'm on LinkedIn. So, you know, feel free to reach out. Shira Gnanaselvam, if you type Gnana, you're likely to find me there very quickly.
yes. Well, I think there will be a strong interest in this topic and in this podcast. So thank you, Shira, for all your insights. It's just been super interesting. And thank you again for taking the initiative to start this very, very data collection. It's really important that we are precise and that we hold our feet to the fire, right, compared to what we're saying. So if you found this podcast episode stimulating, listeners, then be sure to check out some other episodes of my podcast that focus as well on diversity, equity, and inclusion, such as my recent episode that was number 63 with Ajoy Datta, which may also be of interest to you. And you can find this episode and more, not just on my website, 5oaksconsulting.org, that is with the number 5, but also on my YouTube channel. Subscribe to my email list and you will always be the first to be in the know. And with that, this is Tosca, and I look forward to spending time with you next time on NGO Soul and Strategy.
Thanks for listening to my podcast. If you valued the content, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify so that other leaders of social change organizations can find it too. And if you want to learn more, have a look at my website, 5oaksconsulting.org, where you will find blog posts, recordings of interviews with me, as well as information about my co-authored book, Between Power and Irrelevance, The Future of Transnational NGOs. If you sign up for my email list, you will receive a free sneak peek at the book. Or feel free to email me at tosca@5oaksconsulting.org or contact me through my website. And follow me on social media, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook. Till we talk again at NGO Soul and Strategy, the podcast for NGO leaders and managers who look change right in the eye.